ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
From Hitler's secret drug addiction to a wrong turn that started a world war, the past is littered with hidden stories of turning points that changed the world. I'm Mark Fennell, and it is my mission to find them and bring them to you each and every week. No One Saw It Coming is the podcast that will change how you think about history. Find it now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All three engines ready to go. Coming up on the 1 minute point in our countdown. T-minus 1 minute and counting. Sound suppression water system now armed.
January 28, 1986 is an unusually crisp and cold winter morning at Cape Canaveral in Florida.
It's only 2 degrees Celsius and the launch pad is covered in ice and slush.
T-minus 30 seconds and we've had a go for auto-sequence start.
7 people are on board the Space Shuttle Challenger, but this time someone a little different is among the astronauts, a teacher.
Yes, Fee, a teacher. The whole world is watching as a civilian, that very teacher, prepares to leave planet Earth.
We have main engine start, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Bye, Christopher, bye, crew!
Challenger soars into the air and rolls onto its back on its way to orbit.
Roger, roll, Challenger.
But then, a minute into launch...
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Hey, is that trouble or not? They're not having trouble, are they? That's trouble of some kind, George.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
I'm Carl Krzyzanowski, a.k.a. Dr. Carl.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. This is The Challenger Legacy, a 5-part series of science fiction from ABC Radio National.
40 years on from that Challenger disaster, we want to unpack exactly what happened.
When I saw it explode, I couldn't believe it. I don't know why. I just couldn't believe that it happened.
Because there were people who tried to stop that launch.
When he found out that they were going to launch it on that day, he called his boss and he said, we can't launch. He said, it's going to be a catastrophic event.
And there were those who didn't listen.
He totally failed to elevate that issue. That, to me, is almost criminal negligence.
And for the people closest to the disaster, the horror of that day is still painful.
It was wretched. He sobbed. I cried. And the other engineers were just trying to soothe him, telling him he did the right thing.
So how could NASA, the world's leading space agency, make such a monumental mistake?
I think that NASA was an organization that had begun to believe its own press. The root cause of the Challenger accident was hubris.
The reality is that most disasters are not act of God events. In other words, where they're just a fluke, a chance, a weird thing. There are systematic errors that are made along the way.
Were lessons learned? Because in 2003, another disaster occurred.
There is this idea that if you don't change the script, the play always ends the same way.
And now that NASA is getting ready to send astronauts back to the moon for the first time in 50 years, are we ready?
NASA is trying to do too much, and that's of great concern to me.
This is Episode 1, Launch Fever.
Fiona, Fiona, a.k.a. Fee. I am absolutely excited to revisit this story. It's been such a long time. I'm a bit nervous because it actually has a special significance for me.
Why is that?
Well, I actually saw the footage on TV shortly after it happened, back in 1986. You see, I'd started off following the space shuttle early. I've been a big fan of science. I applied to be an astronaut, got knocked back, and I still followed the space shuttle. And I remember that when this happened, it just happened so clearly to me.
So where exactly were you when you saw the disaster unfold?
My mother and I lived on the same block of land on two residences, two houses, and I came in to have breakfast with her, and she said, look at this on the TV. And there it was being played over and over again. And there I was, just a medical student, and here it was happening, this disaster of such monumental proportions.
It was a fireball that turned one teacher's vision of triumph into tragedy.
The worst disaster in the history of the American space program.
The whole of America is in mourning as a huge search continues for wreck.
This is the 10th flight for the shuttle Challenger.
Among the crew of seven was a woman picked to represent the nation's teachers.
So, back in 1986, I was a newborn, so completely unaware of this huge disaster that had unfolded. But recently, I started looking into this story and I was struck by it. I've been speaking to lots of these people who were close to the disaster and they still feel it so much, even 40 years on. Now, I'm a science journalist, but at the heart of this, it's a human story.
So let's start with the space shuttle. It was just an amazing thing. And here they came up with the concept of a reusable spacecraft. Oh my God, to go from no reusable to the first reusable spacecraft. It was an amazing accomplishment.
But also extremely difficult. And I've been speaking to some of the engineers who were behind the design and build of these incredible space shuttles.
Okay, my name is John Tribe. At the time of the shuttle program, I was the chief engineer at Kennedy Space Center for Rockwell International, the designers and builders of the shuttle orbiter.
How many space shuttle flights were you involved in?
I was involved the first 82 flights. So I worked shuttle from 1972 until 2011 in some form.
So essentially, this program was designed to send shuttles into orbit again and again and again.
We had to come up with a reusable vehicle on the basis of cost. We couldn't afford to build a billion-dollar rocket and throw it in the ocean every time. We're going to launch it like a rocket and land it like an aircraft.
Well, his logic is unassailable. I mean, it's stupid to throw away a $1 billion vehicle each time. It makes it sound easy, launch like a rocket, land like an aeroplane, but it was just totally new. Nobody had ever done this before.
It really was. And along with everything else, this was the first system that was going to use solid rocket boosters to get into space.
Well, the advantage of the solid boosters is that you get more bounce per ounce, as they say. You get a huge amount of grunt. Disadvantage? Once you got that big thing going, there was nothing you could do to stop it.
So there were plenty of obstacles to navigate. And if we wind the clock right back to that first ever shuttle launch in April 1981... there was real anxiety that it could just explode there right on the launch pad, and that could end the whole program before it even started.
For the very first flight of a combination of hardware, like an orbiter, a flying vehicle on top of two solid rockets and a great big external tank, and we're going to put two guys up on top of that for the first flight. You know, I don't know whether it was courageous or stupid at the time, but it was. We did it. And I was very fearful. I really was. I personally had a serious concern about, you know, whether we were going to make it or not on that first flight.
5, 4, we've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start. America's first space shuttle. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
I remember reporting on that very first flight on Triple J Live, and my heart was in my mouth, and it was a total success. But then the pressure started to pile on, Fee, didn't it?
Yeah, so the space shuttle program was all about a schedule. NASA just had to keep getting shuttles up because they wanted to prove that flying into space was routine.
The pressures were 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, you couldn't have any more pressure. We worked full time on it, you know, three shifts, round the clock.
this was a long-running problem with the shuttle since its conception.
That's Adam Higginbotham. He's a journalist I spoke to who's reported closely on the space shuttle program and particularly the Challenger disaster.
The idea that you would be able to fly the shuttle into space on a domestic airline schedule was predicated in part on the idea that the shuttle was going to be built with cutting-edge self-diagnostic computer and engineering systems. And so you would just be able to engage in this quick turnaround. The shuttle systems would be so reliable, it would land on the runway at Cape Canaveral like an airliner. It would be taken off the runway and then it could just be sort of cleaned up. But it turned out that the systems were so complicated and subjected to such extraordinary stresses on its passage into orbit and back again, that it just wasn't possible to turn it around at that speed.
And it was John Tribe and his team's job to prepare the shuttles for the next flight.
With several vehicles in flow, we started to literally run out of hardware. We're having to cannibalize hardware from one vehicle to the next to keep it flying. People talked about it becoming operational after four flights. It was never operational in that respect, like an airliner might be. It was a test vehicle all the way through its life.
Hearing those words, that they had to cannibalize parts from one shuttle to put it onto another shuttle, that's just astonishing, because there's a huge amount of labor to take it off and a huge amount of labor to put it on. It would have been just cheaper to have bought the spare part in the first place.
And the other really interesting thing is making spaceflight routine meant that the public started to care less because it was routine.
Because with the moon landings, even with them, which were just monumental achievements, by Apollo 13, they switched off. So there was Apollo 11, watch it. Apollo 12, watch it. Apollo 13, cut to the baseball.
The launches began taking place so frequently that, you know, the major networks in America stopped carrying the launches live. And people essentially got bored of it. You know, they accepted that this was something that was just a day-to-day operation and nothing interesting was going to happen.
Okay, so by the time we get to the mid-1980s, half a decade after we launched the first one, NASA is trying to breathe life into their own public image. They've got to re-engage the public, and so they've come up with something new.
And it was called the Teacher in Space Program.
It's long been a goal of our space shuttle, the program to someday carry citizen passengers into space. Until now, we hadn't decided who the first citizen passenger would be. But today I'm directing NASA to begin a search in all of our elementary and secondary schools and to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
Rather than just having professional astronauts in space, we would have a regular person on board, and it was determined that who better to do this than a teacher who could then convey the more human side of spaceflight to the public.
So that's Steve Nesbitt, and back in 1985, he was the public affairs officer for NASA.
Krista McAuliffe was selected, so it was going to be a really big operation where she would teach from space. For more than a year leading up to the flight, we had had a tremendous increase in interest from both the public and the media. Media from all over the world, but the level of it was just through the roof.
As the first space participant, I'd just like to say that I am very delighted to be part of this crew. Everybody's been wonderful in making me feel a part of this mission.
This one was going to be very special. The crowds that were going to be in Florida for this were just incredible. Many, many, many thousands of people were going to be out on the roads around the launch site watching the launch. The Teacher in Space mission really had achieved its goal of bringing home the experience of space flight to regular people.
I think it's going to be very exciting for kids to be able to turn on the TV and see the teacher teaching from space.
So this was the 10th flight for the Challenger spacecraft, and it was set to be a special one. Sophie, who else was on board?
So along with Krista McAuliffe, there were six other crew members.
I am Dr. June Scobie Rogers. I am the widow of the commander of this Challenger space shuttle, Dick Scobee.
Now, Dick was a test pilot. He'd served in the Vietnam War, and then in the late 70s, he was selected to become an astronaut.
He came home one day with a wanted ads, and he pointed out to one that says, new space shuttle astronauts needed.
So Dick first went to space in 1984. He was piloting one of the earlier flights of the space shuttle Challenger. And June still remembers how excited he was on his return.
As soon as we were home, there were reporters everywhere around our house and neighbors, everyone that wanted to hear about his flight in space. And he said, June, you've supported me, saw me through thick and thin until here I was an astronaut. I want to tell you first what it was like to fly in space. So off we went out the back door and away to our favorite restaurant. And there, that night, as he talked about his space flight, the stars outside that window were as bright as those in his eyes. He was filled with joy. But at one point I said, why are you tucking your napkin under your plate? Oh, he said, I was afraid it might float away.
So then not long after the return of that first mission, Dick was asked to command the Teacher in Space flight. And here's Dick introducing his crew at a press conference in 1985.
It's a pleasure being here with you all this morning. This good-looking group off to my right, I'd like to introduce them one at a time by specialty. So without further ado, Elson Onizuka is our expert on the tracking data relay satellite, the inertial upper stage. Ron McNair is our expert on the Spartan Halley, the comet research satellite we're carrying on board. Mike Smith, our pilot. Judy Resnick, who's our flight engineer. Greg Jarvis, who's one of our payload specialists, and of course, Krista McAuliffe, our teacher in space, who will be doing teacher activities the whole flight.
Wow, so some of the crew were incredibly experienced, and they had their own specialties, and they knew them backwards 15 ways from breakfast, but then some were rookies.
Exactly. All incredibly accomplished in their own fields, and they'd gone through rigorous training to be where they were, but someone like Dick Scobee, with his background as a test pilot, he was potentially more aware of the dangers involved.
The idea of the shuttle being like an airline, he said, no. I mean, if the public relations want to state it like that, that's okay. But it is definitely still an aircraft that is being tested. He was so concerned that he asked me one day, there are 10 finalist teachers, and they're still being told it's like a commercial aircraft.
And as the commander of the mission, it seemed Dick felt a responsibility to spell out the risks to the teacher applicants. And so he explained.
It isn't just a commercial flight, to be aware. And in case you're the one selected and you don't want to be, now is the time to back out. No one backed out.
The crew are originally meant to launch on January 23, 1986, but the launch is pushed back multiple times during that week. And you can just imagine that pressure building up all the way through the organisation to get this beautiful beast off the ground.
Absolutely. And then eventually, Tuesday, January 28th becomes the day. But what a day. John Tribe remembers that morning distinctly.
What happened was that one day slip put us into the coldest day of the year in Florida. To be below freezing for most of the night was unheard of.
As the sun rises, it's minus 5 degrees Celsius at the pad, and there are icicles hanging from parts of the launch structure. For a while, the crew and the staff think that this mission is going to be scrubbed again.
I said, when the vehicle lifts off, the debris generated by all that ice breaking up and flying around is going to be destructive. And I said, we got no way to establish, you know, how bad that's going to be. But there was enough of an issue in my mind to say no go that day.
But, see, NASA does not stop the launch, do they?
No.
No.
They don't stop it. They delay for an hour or two so that the ice can melt. Steve Nesbitt was NASA's commentator for the day.
Leading up to the last 20, 30 minutes or so before launch, I was still thinking we probably would not launch that day, mostly because of the weather. But I think as we got down to within 20 minutes and it was getting clear that they were going to go for it, it suddenly got a lot more serious.
So as the mission commentator, Steve described what was happening at each stage of the launch for the people watching in person and everyone around the world.
Wow. So Steve was in the hot seat coming out with the words when everything unfolded. What a day to be in a chair.
So, Carl, I'm going to show you the footage now of that very launch.
Wow, I haven't seen this for 40 years. Okay, so we've got a blue sky. We've got the big boosters throwing out the big flame. That's 70-something percent of the thrust. And you can just see the little three blue boosts coming out of the back of the... oh, my God, it just blew. Oh, God. Oh, my God, it just sort of blew. I just felt this wave. And you can see going that terrible Y shape where... You got the flame coming up from the bottom left, and then it breaks into a Y, and one solid booster goes one way, and the other solid booster goes the other way, and the space shuttle, there's not going to be a happy ending from this.
When I looked at the screen and I first saw that this was dreadfully wrong, it was, to me, feeling like someone had dropped a 100-pound sack of cement in my lap. It was unexpected, just shocking, and I just felt stunned.
But as the mission commentator, Steve had a job to do.
And I knew I had to say something because there were hundreds of thousands of people watching it, including the families of the astronauts on board. The thing I chose to say was...
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink. We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
All I remember really from that period is watching on TV the one wing of the orbiter coming down like a falling leaf, probably plummeting down, you know, at terminal velocity, but it just didn't look like that on TV. It looked like it was a falling leaf coming down. I thought, oh, God. They've gone.
But for those less familiar with space shuttle launches, the scale of what was unfolding before them was much less obvious.
It took quite a long time for people in the stands to realise exactly what had happened.
So that's Adam Higginbotham, and he's spoken to people who were there at the Cape on the day.
A lot of people in the crowd, you know, many of whom had never witnessed a shuttle launch before, and knew only that the solid rockets were designed to drop away from the shuttle stack at a certain point on its way to orbit. You know, they don't realize that something has gone wrong. They think that that what they're seeing is intentional. And so when the disintegration takes place, there is not a kind of shocked reaction in the crowd initially. There's confusion. And it takes a while before people really understand what's happened.
We come together today to mourn the loss of seven brave Americans, to share the grief that we all feel, and perhaps in that sharing to find the strength to bear our sorrow and the courage to look for the seeds of hope.
On the next episode of The Challenger Legacy.
Once it launched and got past the pad, he bent down and whispered in my ear and he said, "It's not over yet." And then it exploded.
In the wake of the disaster, there's a search for what went wrong. for something beyond the icy conditions on that Tuesday morning.
The whole program was aware of the erosion problem after STS-2, which was in November of 1981.
And the search for what and who was to blame.
And he said, "You've got it all wrong. There was no miscommunication that night. We told them it was not safe to launch, and they wouldn't hear it."
Here we were trying to prevent the very problem that happened, and as a group, we failed.
The Challenger legacy was made on the lands of the Gadigal and Meenang Noongar people for ABC Radio National. It's reported and presented by me, Fiona Pepper.
With me, Carl Krushlanitsky. The show's senior producer is James Bullen, and our sound engineer is Timothy Jenkins. You can follow Science Friction on the ABC Listen app to hear more. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.